Hey, Bullseye listeners, it is Jesse. So we got the unfortunate news this week that Terry Jones passed away. Obviously, like any other self-respecting comedy nerd, I grew up obsessed with Monty Python. And I also grew up obsessed with a book that Terry Jones wrote called Fairy Tales, which is beautiful and still in print. And so for that reason, when I had the opportunity to interview Terry Jones, I was genuinely terrified. Like when people ask me sometimes if I'm nervous about doing interviews, I say no, and that's generally true. Like unless I haven't had the time I'd like to prepare or something like that, I generally feel fine about my interviews. You know, people are people, and so forth. But I vividly remember being in my apartment in Koreatown, from which I recorded this interview, and looking at my finger as I was dialing the phone and realizing that it was actually literally shaking. Anyway, this conversation was one of the things that convinced me that I needn't be nervous about interviews because Terry Jones was such a brilliant and hilarious, but ultimately lovely and kind man as well. It was so nice of him to do this interview on my show when very few people listen to my show, and it is one of the greatest highlights of my career. So in memory of a great artist and a kind man, my conversation from almost 14 years ago, 2006.
You're listening to The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart. My guest on the program, Terry Jones, is a founding member of Monty Python's Flying Circus, as well as an author, a film writer, a director, and right now you're actually working on re-editing the soundtrack for Eric the Viking, which was a film you made in the mid-80s.
It's a film I made about 16 years ago called Eric the Viking, and I was never really quite pleased with it, with the edit and the way it was. And normally with films and all the Python movies, I've always edited hands-on myself, and for some reason this one I just sort of let the editor get on with it, and I stepped back, and it all seemed to be going pretty well. And it was only about 10 days, 2 weeks before we were due to open in London, that I actually sat down with it, and I suddenly realized there was an awful lot I could take out. And so I managed to get about 10 minutes out of it, but by that time, in America, they'd already printed 250 copies of the long version, so that's what went out over there. And then just before Christmas, Sony said they were going to re-release it on a DVD, and they were going to call it the Director's Cut. And I said, hey, wait a minute, you can't call it the Director's Cut, because it isn't my cut. Even though it's a shorter version, I could still do an awful lot more to it. So I've had a great thrill of re-editing it, and we're now just doing the sound. So it's a triple thrill, because I've been meaning to do it for 16 years. I've been working with the best editor I've ever worked with, and he's my son. Now, what we're going to do, what we're calling it, we're not going to call it the Director's Cut. We're going to call it the Director's Son's Cut. Because really, he's changed the scene order and sharpened it up no end. It really looks really good now.
For a lot of people, I know I worked with my father for a little while, and it was a total disaster, I have to say.
Well, I don't know. Bill and I get on very well, so it's all right.
It seems like it's the rather rare director's cut that might be shorter than the original.
Yeah, it's quite a bit shorter, in fact. I mean, my cut was 10 minutes shorter than than my editor's cut, and this is now another 25 minutes shorter than the original film.
So Monty Python's Flying Circus is coming back to television, or at least to non-cable, to broadcast television here in the United States, and it's going to be distributed in April by PBS for the first time, although it was when it originally ran on U.S. television, it was run on primarily on PBS stations.
Yeah.
This is like 30 years later now. And does it ever feel totally normal that this creation that you participated in 30 years ago has this amazing staying power?
Well, yes, it does make life seem very short, you know. But it's surprising. I mean, I must say, I think we all thought when we were making the film, the TV shows, I think we all thought, well, we're going to do the funniest thing around at the moment, but we didn't expect people to be still looking at it in 30 years' time. And in fact, we didn't think it would be technically possible, because when we actually started in 69, the first shows, you really couldn't, there was no home video machines. So, you know, we didn't expect to that people would be able to watch at-will programs. And we were very lucky to actually get it, because the BBC nearly wiped the programs. In fact, if it hadn't been for... I mean, what happened was, in those days, after a couple of years, they would automatically wipe comedy programs. That means, you know, erase them. And our editor in the BBC phoned me up and said, "Hey, they're going to erase the Python, the first series of Python, in a month's time." So we smuggled the tapes out of the BBC and recorded them onto the only domestic video that was just coming onto the market. It was a Philips thing. And it was called a VCR. You couldn't play them now. And for a long time, I thought those were going to be the only evidence of these shows, and they were sitting in my cellar. But then, thanks to you chaps in the States, the BBC suddenly changed its mind, because they started selling the shows to America. So we were saved.
What place did you imagine Python having in the comedy firmament when it was first created? I mean, what was your goal with it then?
Well, I think the goal was just to do something funny, really. We just thought we could do the funniest stuff and also try and do something that was different to what had gone before and had a different shape. And I think I was very concerned to break up the kind of the formats of television comedy. In those days, you know, you'd either have a half-hour comedy, a situation comedy, or else you'd have sketches, and they'd be sort of have beginnings, middles, and ends. Or you'd have quickies, which would be sort of 30 seconds of the one joke. And so we were trying to break that up a bit.
One of the interesting things about the Python television series was the way that all of the sketches were linked together, which is not typical in television sketch comedy. And you mentioned the not having beginnings, middles, and ends. I think those links kind of get you out of the requirement of always having to have beginnings, middles, and ends, and particularly ends, which can be quite difficult in sketch comedy.
Exactly, yes.
But at the same time, I mean, it imposes a whole other requirement. I know when I interviewed Bob Odenkirk, who created the sketch comedy series Mr. Show, and they decided to do that very same thing with links between sketches. And he told me that about halfway through the first season, they realized what a horrible mistake that was, because they spent about as much time trying to think of links between sketches as they did actually writing comedy.
Yeah. Well, because we were lucky. I mean, the idea of doing, having a show with that flowed like that really came out of an animation that Terry Gilliam had done for a TV show that Mike Palin, Eric Idle, and I were doing with Terry Gilliam called Do Not Adjust Your Set. It was a children's show. And Terry had done this... He said, "I've done this animation. It's sort of chain of consciousness, and it doesn't really mean anything. It doesn't just goes from one thing to another." And I was thinking, when we were trying to think about what shape the show would be, I suddenly remembered Terry's elephant cartoon. It was called Elephants. And I thought, well, you could do that throughout the whole show. So, of course, we were lucky in having Terry there to actually do links for us. And links were pretty easy for us, actually.
How did you sell this whole idea? I mean, how did you convince the powers that be that this... I mean, it's a very odd television show, let's face it.
Well, I think it would be very difficult to do that now, I have to say. But in those days, the BBC was a kind of totally different sort of organization. It wasn't interested in, how much money it could make and how big the audience was going to be. I mean, it was concerned that audience size, but it trusted... it was much more anarchic organization. It trusted it's the producers. You know, the producers were the top dogs. They'd been selected, they'd been trained, and the BBC, the people running the programming, trusted the producers. And I have to say, they wanted to do something with John Cleese, and John wanted to work with Mike and me, and we went along to a meeting of the program planners, kind of thing, and there were all these guys in suits sitting around the table, and they said, "Well, you know, what's this program going to be about?" And we sort of said, "Well, we don't really know." And they said, "Oh, well, it's going to have music in it." And we said, "Well, we don't know." And they said, well, who's it going to be aimed at? And we said, well, we don't know. And they said, well, what's it going to be called? And we said, well, we don't know. So they all looked at each other and all went, oh, dear, dear, dear. Well, look, we can only give you 13 shows, you know. I don't think, I can't see that happening nowadays.
Do you think that an idea of what the show was, I mean, above and beyond simply funny, evolved during the process of making it? Do you think that it has a certain idea or a certain aesthetic that binds it together?
Well, I think it's got the aesthetic in terms of just the sort of the sum total of the six of us and our comic sensibility, I guess. So I suppose that kind of holds it together. But I don't know, at the time, we were just trying to make every show totally unpredictable. So the fact that, you know, the word pythonic has now entered in the Oxford English Dictionary now, means that we totally failed. You know, we were trying to surprise everybody every week, but obviously we didn't succeed.
You're listening to The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart. My guest is Terry Jones, an author, writer, director, and founding member of Monty Python. Now, Terry, you you co-directed with Terry Gilliam the Holy Grail film, and you directed the two Python films that came after that.
Yeah.
These all came out after the initial run of the series. What led you into the film arena? And I know now for something completely different, which was a kind of an omnibus of sketches film had come out during the series. But why did you go into features?
Well, I've never really liked television. I always wanted to get into films and do films. I thought was a bit disappointing because it was just the TV sketches. And I must say, I was very keen to do a film. And after that, I think enough something completely different didn't really do much business. So John wasn't terribly keen and sort of had to be cajoled into the idea of doing the Holy Grail. And then it was very uncomfortable and unpleasant doing it. But then once we'd done it, and then that was successful and made money, then it became a bit easier to persuade the others to do Life of Brian. But it was really film is what I've always wanted to do.
Was that because of just kind of a general snobbishness, or was that because there were specific things about film that you could do, or specific qualities of film that you could utilize that you couldn't do on television?
Well, I think basically it's the big screen. I just love the big screen, and I've always found a television screen a bit too containing, a bit too cramped. But also I think there is the fact that you can actually spend more time in a feature film. You know, you can actually do things and perfect things and try and make things work, which you don't have time on television. I mean, you know, the demands of television are such that you're churning out material. Although we did take time on the Python shows, when we were editing the shows, I mean, Ian McNaughton, who was the director, he'd sort of think, well, we could get away with two hours of editing. And I'd turn up in the morning, we'd spend the entire day editing. because, you know, you can improve things so much. Actually, talking about editing, even spending a whole day editing the show wasn't enough. And when we came to do these, the personal best of Python, we've done these DVDs, which I think are going out on PBS, which were our kind of personal pick. And it was a great opportunity to re-edit the actual TV shows. And things like, in my choice, there's one about the killer joke. It's a joke that's so funny that it's people die laughing, and so it gets used as a weapon in the war. That last, it was 9.5 minutes when it went out on television, and I was able to get down to 6 minutes. In other words, I cut out 3.5 minutes without losing a single joke. And it's now much more how I imagined it when we wrote it.
I read something very interesting in an interview that you did shortly after the premiere of Spamalot, which was the Broadway musical that Eric Idle adapted from Holy Grail, which was that, as wonderful as it was, one of the things that you seem to think that it lost from the film was the kind of darkness and grotesquerie, which of course isn't, you know, it's pretty hard to put grotesquerie on the Broadway stage.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about how this Middle Ages setting for Holy Grail and this kind of dark, death-filled world was conducive for making jokes.
Well, you know, our original script for Holy Grail, half of it was set in the Middle Ages, half of it was set in the modern day, and it sort of banged backwards and forwards. But it just happened that I was sort of working on a book on Chaucer at the time, and I kind of was pretty keen on setting it in the Middle Ages, and so, and to my surprise, everybody agreed to go along with that. So, you know, any setting is going to be conducive to making jokes. You know, it's just, but the great thing is try and create a real environment that you can then do silly things in.
Both Holy Grail and Life of Brian are very much period pieces, and very much come from these kind of big, important cultural myths, like really capital letter M central myths to Western culture. Why choose those two like really huge topics first time out for a feature film from a series that had been, you know, a series of sketches that were, you know, maybe like about class, but, you know, pretty slight?
Well, I think it's the same reason, really. It's easier to do something within the context that looks serious and that people know about already. It gives you sort of the carte blanche to do to play off against that world that everybody recognizes. So I think it's the same thing, really, as doing silly things with men in bowler hats and moustaches. You just create a world that people recognize and accept as being a realish world or a real world, and then you can do silly things in it. And I think that's what we were doing. And I don't think in either case were we particularly parodying the styles. I mean, of, you know, like we don't think we were parodying the Arthurian legends. I think we were actually taking the Arthurian legends in the Holy Grail and actually enjoying doing silly things within the terms of reference of those legends, which is sort of slightly different from actually making fun of those kind of films.
You're listening to The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart. My guest on the program is Terry Jones. So you were actually writing your first book, which is Chaucer's Knight, at the same time that you were making Holy Grail, or at least preparing to make Holy Grail. What was it about that Middle Ages world that got you excited to do comedy in that world?
It was the boring bits of Chaucer that got me interested, because
you mean,
I couldn't
doesn't
believe
that mean Chaucer,
who writes such funny stuff in some places, would have written these very boring, dull pieces, which is what we were being told he did. So I was trying to explain these 30 lines about the knight in the prologue to the Canterbury Tales, and trying to work out what he was actually talking about. And in order to try and find out what he was talking about, I had to start reading about the time and trying to find out a bit more. And to my utter amazement, I found myself getting sort of dragged into sort of late 14th century military history, which is not something I thought I would be interested in. But then, you know, you find that it's history is vital. It's like you see the same people going on. The context is different, of course, but the same people taking power, seizing power, holding on to power, and using the same techniques that people are using today. And that's really, in a way, how it made me become more political.
Do you think that any of your comedy was political?
It wasn't really. No, it was always kind of always shied away from politics, and it's more kind of about, you know, sort of people and, you know, human foibles, I think. So if it's satirical in any way, it's satirical in the old sense of being sort of a satire on mankind rather than on any individuals nowadays in party politics.
I think maybe because you're British, and maybe because you ran on PBS, maybe because of glancing references to literature and philosophy. Monty Python in the United States has a reputation as being very intellectual humor, which I don't know. Personally, I don't know if I've ever really bought into that. But how do you feel about that, about having that reputation?
Well, I think it was a bit of a blind that we were putting up, really, because we know, because it mentions Kierkegaard or something like that. But basically, the jokes are really pretty stupid, and it's pretty silly stuff. But again, it's like using intellectual furniture, just like using the Arthurian legends or men in bowler hats. You know, you take something that looks very straight, and then it's easier to do silly things within that context. But I certainly think we never thought about, oh, well, people never heard of Thomas Hobbes or René Descartes. So we just sort of assumed that everybody would know about what we're talking about. And if they didn't, well, too bad.
After having had, you know, the popularity of Python stay at a relatively continuous level for the last 30 years or so, maybe even growing, do you get a feeling for what kind of people really appreciate the humor that you did?
No, I mean, I didn't know really at all. I mean, we certainly found that we appealed more to men. I mean, this country appealed more to men than to women. So we never really got groupies when we were going around doing the tours.
That must have been a disappointment.
Yes, I know. It was a real... it's also rather, you know, sort of young, spotty men in anoraks, really. which wasn't my taste at all. But it's I don't know. But I mean, the one thing was, it was always the first reactions we really got when the shows first went out on BBC. I mean, for about 4 weeks, we just seemed to be doing the show in limbo. Nobody. We had an audience in the studio, but apart from that, we weren't getting any reactions at all. We didn't know whether people were liking it or what. And then we started getting letters in from the from kids at school and things like that, and the school kids that really, you know, started with the first fans of the show.
When was the show running at the time?
It went out about, I think it was generally about 9:30, 10 o'clock, something like that. I think it was BBC One actually. Everybody thinks it was BBC Two, but I think it may have been 10:30 on BBC One, something like that. And usually, I think it was a Thursday or Friday night, I think.
Can we do another 5 minutes or so? Is that okay?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, then. Oh God, yes. I'm sorry. I'm so sort of involved in doing this. We're redubbing at the moment. We just got the. We're just putting new noises on and under the film, and it's getting very exciting. The film is quite different. It's really interesting.
It's funny to think of the idea of adding in sound elements as being exciting, I think.
Man, it is. It's like, you know, we had these characters called the Dog Soldiers, and they're sort of... The film was designed by Alan Lee, who... it was the first time he'd never thought about doing films, actually. He was a book illustrator who I knew and who I'd worked with. And I suddenly thought he'd be ideal to sort of do the design for Eric the Viking. And, of course, he went on there from there to do Lord of the Rings, all three episodes. I mean, he's like now a kind of a top film designer. But he designed these headgear for which are these huge long skeletons and heads for these dog soldiers on this boat, and they never really looked terribly frightening. So what we've been doing is we've been putting growls on them, and now they suddenly look frightening. You know, oh God, yeah, they really are scary.
One of the things that you've done a lot in the 30 years or so since Python, or the 25 years, I guess, since the last Python film, is children's entertainment. A lot of people, I think, get into children's entertainment when they have kids of their own. Was that the case for you?
Yeah, I started writing books for kids when my daughter was five, and I thought, oh, great, I can read her fairy tales now. And I bought The Brothers Grimm for her. And I started reading, I think it was Snow White, actually. And you get to the end of this story. And in the original version, which I was reading, the wicked stepmother is punished by being made to put on red-hot iron slippers and dance until she falls down dead. I thought, I can't read this. My little daughter's ready to go to sleep thinking, oh, I'm so glad they tortured that old lady to death. I thought, well, I can't read this sort of stuff. So the next day I sort of sat out and started writing my own fairy tales. And then when I had when my son arrived, then I had to write something for him, so I wrote the saga of Eric the Viking. So it's kind of nice. So the book of Eric the Viking was written for Bill, and in fact I'd forgotten that the film is actually dedicated to him. And here he is, sort of like 16 years later, he gets his chance to have his own say about the film.
you've worked in this kind of fairy tale and fantasy world a lot since in the past 20 years or so. I mean, you mentioned your book Fairy Tales, which actually. I have to say, I'm 24, and my mom used to read me from that book when I was, you know, however old it is that your mom reads you from that book, five, four, or five. I was born the year the book came out. But you've worked very extensively in that field, and I mean, I think to a certain extent, you know, everything that's connected with the myths of the Middle Ages is deeply connected to the world of fantasy. Mm. What do you think is appealing for you about that world?
Well, I've always liked fantasy. I don't know why it is. It's just that's how I am. I've always enjoyed the world of the fantastic, or world one remove from reality. Maybe it was growing up in the 40s, because I was born in 1942. So my childhood was spent in the 40s in England, when it was pretty rough. You know, there was nothing much in the shops, and we were suffering from the after effects of the Second World War. And it was pretty austere, in fact. And maybe that was it. Maybe it was easier to escape into the world of Rupert the Bear and the world of animals and imaginary worlds than to live in the real world. And certainly, that's always been my, you know, I found it easier to understand an imaginary world than to understand the real world.
One of the credits on your resume that, as I was reading about you this past week, I didn't know was that you wrote the screenplay for the film Labyrinth, which was a Jim Henson film, a Jim Henson children's fantasy film from the mid 1980s. How did you get involved in that project?
Well, it was very odd, actually. I was actually thinking about doing a film of Eric the Viking at the time, and I. Suddenly, well, I suppose, you know, somebody like Jim Henson would be the person to sort of get involved in doing the monsters and things. So I got his number, and I phoned up his secretary, his assistant, Jill, and she said, well, funny enough, he was trying to get hold of you, because he's got this thing, Labyrinth, that he was wondering whether you'd be interested in writing the screenplay for. So instead of him getting involved in Eric the Viking, I got roped into Labyrinth.
Did you? What was it like working with him? Did you have?
Oh, he's a lovely man. He was a really, really nice, good man to work with. And I was working with him and Brian Froud, who is a wonderful artist, and who really all the images in Dark Crystal and Labyrinth, they're really all out of Brian's head. Actually, he did all the sort of the concept design and. How we worked on Labyrinth was they were ready about 6 months or 3 months into production. They'd got all these puppets and things, but they didn't have a script or a story, really. So I took a lot of Brian's drawings and then wrote a screenplay, just sort of, you know, every time I came to a new scene, I'd just thumb through his drawings and see, oh, that's a nice character. I like him. There's a old man with a hat which is a duck on the top, so the duck talks, so obviously he's having an argument with the duck all the time. So it was really quite fun, actually, to interact off stuff that was already there like that.
In a certain way, a lot of the stuff in your career, a lot of the fiction has been interpretive, whether it's it's reinterpreting Arthurian legend, or you know the kind of legends about Vikings for Eric the Viking, or this kind of thing.
Yeah, no, I suppose that's true. Really, I mean, again, it's this thing about working within a context that's recognisable. It's sort of it's quite fun. I mean, the last thing I did was Wind in the Willows again, which was an adaptation of a book. So but it gives you a context to work within, and that's quite fun. I mean, not that I don't want to make my own things. I'm actually sort of trying to get time to finish writing a book that I'm in the middle of, which I think could make a good movie as well. So I'm dying to get back to that, really.
What's the nature of the new book?
It's called Evil Machines, and it's about, really. So at the moment, it's a book of short stories, but they all turn, towards the end, you realize they're all connected. Of course, the film won't be like that at all. It'll have to take the end story, really. But it's quite fun. It's a world in which, you know, people and machines all talk to each other all the time, and the machines are always undermining the human beings.
Well, Terry, I know you have to get back to your son and get back to your work there.
Very good.
It was a real pleasure having you on the show.
Well, it was very nice to talk to you, Jesse, and all the best.